Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
In today's economic climate, construction cost and schedule overruns can be disastrous.
Innate construction software helps you spot risks before they happen.
Their cloud-based solutions give you the real-time insights you need to minimize risk and improve operational efficiency.
With Innate, you keep projects on schedule and under budget. Get started today at innate.com. That's INEIGHT.com.
In this episode, we talk to Rob Farris about project managing in film production and a lot more. Rob started his career in media, like so many others, as a runner. He moved into project managing the post-production of films after a few years. His feature film credit was on the Bond film Quantum of Solace. Over the subsequent 15 years, he has amassed over 200 films and TV show credits, including Oscar and BAFTA winning titles such as Belfast and The Banshees of Inisherin.
As director of post-production, he oversees a world-renowned post facility in Soho, London, which offers high-end picture and sound services to the industry's biggest studios and streamers. He lives in Surrey with his wife and two daughters. Now, Val, we had a lot of fun and learned a lot from Rob and what happens in films. We spoke everything from what post-production actually means, all the way through to AI, ethics, what that means, the future of film production, the responsibility of what films mean and how they instigate creativity. But what were some of the key highlights for you?
It was great to know. I think just his overall energy and passion really came across for the industry, but also how they plan projects and they really develop for post-production. I mean, there's a lot of synergies between what they do and what we do in the project delivery space, but it's also interesting to see, we talked and touched on AI, as you would expect from now on, and how that's affecting, you know, writers and other people in those industries. And we kind of went really divergent by the end, thinking about what could be. So I thought that was very exciting as well.
Yeah, agreed. And he does name drop at the end. We give him the license to do it. Some of the actors and, you know, sort of directors and films he's worked on, and what a pedigree he's got. But we won't spoil it for everyone. We'll leave it there, folks. Get tucked into this one. As we say, keep listening, keep liking, and keep paying it forward.
Hello, project people. Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Project Chatter podcast. It's always good to have you back. And we got a pretty interesting episode today. Before I get into it, how are you, Mr. Dale?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good, you know, just looking forward to some. I think we had a little bit of hot weather a few weeks ago. Now it's cooler again, Val. And I like to tell you about the summer in the UK when it's winter in Australia, in your hoodie there with your hot cup of coffee.
We've been doing this for a while, and this is the only annoying thing I hate is when it's summer in the UK, because Dale just gives me grief the whole time. But it will be summer in Adelaide and Melbourne and Sydney and Queensland soon. So I'll be doing a lot of trips around Australia to catch up with a bunch of people. But before we get into the podcast, mate, do you want to do a bit of an intro to this? Because this is something different. We don't usually have guests outside the rim of projects, but this could be very, very interesting for our listeners. Do you want to give a bit of an intro to?
Me doing the intro. You're the master of intros, but... Honestly, so I'll give a bit of a backstory. I know we haven't even got our guests yet to say anything, but you know, we love and know Chirag Shah, right? We've had Chirag on the podcast a few times, and I was at an event with Chirag, and we got chatting, and one of Chirag's very good friends just happened to be in film production, and his name happened to be Rob Farris, and he's our guest today. And I thought, wouldn't it be fascinating to talk about what is in film production, particularly post-production, but all aspects of it. So Rob, thank you so much for joining us. You have a fantastic pedigree. We've got a bio of yours, but I think it's a very condensed version based on, you know, what you've done. But yeah, welcome. How are you?
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. This is something very different for me, but really interesting to be here. And I'm glad that, you know, you guys thought this would be interesting, because, like you say, it's very different to the pods I've heard. And I wondered how this would work. How would I contribute to this field? So it's really interesting to be here and talk about, you know, what projects are in film post-production. And talk a little bit about film and something different, you know, for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm gonna steal Val's opening line here, because he loves to do this, and he has asked me to do the intro. So I'm gonna take the baton full on. And Rob, if you don't mind giving the listeners your origin story. I mean, how did you fall into film production, and sort of from falling into it, or maybe it was a choice? How did you get to where you are today? Can you give us a bit of a backstory?
Do you know what's interesting? Falling into it is an interesting way of putting it, because I think that having always been really interested and passionate about film and TV, mainly film, because I think that's what, you know, growing up in the 80s and 90s, film was such an iconic thing. I was always involved in filmmaking, and, you know, extremely amateur and really passionate about doing that. And then went off to pursue, you know, the early iterations of film degrees, where things were practical, but there wasn't a lot of access to really practical things. So you were working with pretty low level equipment and low level technology, because a lot of these universities didn't have access to the high end things. And because the world was still very film based then, and it's very digital based now, but it was very film based then. So again, there wasn't a lot of access outside of some very niche film schools. But I did a documentary film degree, which was great fun and you know, a great use of time. And then I wanted to get into film specifically, and got a break as a runner. Like so many people do, it really is the way into the industry, is working as a runner, making tea, smiling at people, trying to be part of the industry. And then you say you fall into it. Well, you know, I smiled at the right people and got on with people and talked to people. And after only a few months, got an opportunity to move into the sort of the admin side of a company. And my passion was film editing. And I was certain I was going to be a film editor. But I took that first opportunity, because opportunities are rare. You know, that taking that first step out of being a runner, you got to take what's given to you to get that step and, you know, make that move. And then I fell in love with the admin side and talking to people and working on, you know, on in a project sense of how do these things work and how do we manage, you know, how do we manage post-production? And then through a series of, you know, meeting the right people and making the right impression, worked my way into eventually being what's called a DI producer. So that's like a post-production digital intermediate, DI, so that's a digital intermediate. And that's a specific process that forms a very important part of filmmaking. And that was, you know, 15, no, goodness me, a long time ago now, 2008. So yeah, so too long ago, was 15 years ago. And got an amazing opportunity to work on a Bond film, The Quantum of Solace, and then loved it and fell into continuing to work on these amazing films and TV shows to, you know, for the next 15 or so years.
Wow. You've worked on some pretty cool films, which I'm sure we'll get into. But for the uninitiated, right, what is exactly involved in film production, post-production? What is it? What does it actually mean? Because for most, I gather, for most of the public watching anything, whether it be on the big screen or on Netflix or anywhere else, all you see is the end result, right? But there's a lot of work that goes into getting to that end result, and a lot of pieces that have to, you know, fall into place. And they don't just fall into place. It's a lot of hard work. And you're involved in that. So I mean, it sounds obvious post-production, but what does it actually mean in terms of what is the, I guess, the value add or the stuff you do to make the film what it is?
So it's interesting because, as you say, like most people just see that end product on Netflix. What they don't see, because Netflix don't allow you to see it, are the credits or what happens after the end of that episode, because it, you know, it. And I remember the moment that Netflix, we sort of found out that Netflix were going to be removing the credits from films. And we were like, hang on a minute. Like, because we'd worked with Netflix for quite a few years at that moment. And they were like, we found out that they were going to allow you to, you know, skip the credits. And we were like, oh man, that's quite a big moment in the industry to lose, you know, 1,000 people that have worked on this film, because they can keep everyone in, because who wants to sit through 5 minutes, you know? I tell you a story about that, but I'll tell you about that now. With the film, like that first film I ever worked on, I said to my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, I said, we should go and watch that film, that Bond film, in the cinema. And she said, yeah, let's go with all our mates. And so we all went, and we went and sat in the cinema to see this, because my name was going to appear in the credits. And and we last minute, and we got a row of 12 of us, you know, like sort of third to the back row. It wasn't great seats, but it was fine. And we watched this film, and at the end, everyone gets up, you know, the credits start, everyone gets up to go. Well, our row stayed. And so the row behind us, because that everyone sort of noticed that we were staying, and the row behind us said, hey, do you think there's something at the end? Do you think there's like something, like a secret scene at the end of the film? So the row behind us stayed, and you could see them sort of chatting, going like, well, this not aren't going, we should go, maybe there is. And the row behind them and the row behind them. Anyway, you know, literally you wait 5 minutes, a film like a Bond film, there's thousands of people that have worked on this film going through, okay. And eventually my name, you know, you have to look really carefully, but there it is. It crawls through. As soon as it appears on the screen, we all jump up. We're, way! And then, of course, as soon as it goes, we're out. And the people behind us are like, hang on a minute, what have we just done here? We've waited 5 minutes here for absolutely no reason. What's happened? But anyway, Netflix, they still let you to skip. But if you go to the cinema, you can stay and see. So what do we do? So a film, you know, a film starts years often before, you know, before maybe I'm heavily involved, and you know, we'll often see a script early, if we're engaged in that project early, we have no input at that point. You know, we're just being, you know, it's just there to really help us understand, you know, what we're going to be need to do whenever this comes to us, but. They'll go off and they'll shoot their film. We'll be involved maybe in the very outset, testing some cameras and testing some looks for the film or the TV show, you know, thinking at that point, how do we want this to be? You know, being involved at that outset is really important to make sure that the look of the show is established at the start, so that everyone kind of understands what sort of thing are we making. And then they'll shoot the film. We'll possibly visit set depending on where it is, and we'll be involved in seeing some of the things that are happening. We'll see some what's called dailies, so every day the film or the TV show will have some of the things they've shot will be shared for people to see and make sure that things are going well, but then it'll go away and be edited, and that can be 16 weeks, it could be 20 weeks, that could be 50 weeks, you know, on a big, you know, on a huge show, it could, maybe they're cutting for a year. There's a lot of visual effects maybe. And then it's going to come to us, and they're going to take it from that point of the film is going to finish editing. They're going to lock the cut and they're going to hand it over to us. And then that's where we're going to then work on that at the highest resolution. Maybe that's returning to the original physical film that's been shot. Maybe that's looking at the high res digital media that they've used. And we're going to build that film back out. We're going to be cutting in all those visual effects, making sure that everything is as it should be. And then a really important part of the company that I work for is looking after the color grading. So making sure that things look the same. You know, they shoot a film over maybe, you know, 20 weeks. there is lighting, there's weather, there's all sorts of things that are going to go wrong and going to, you know, make this a difficult thing. Maybe they're doing some pickup shoots, you know, months later, you know, where your actor is maybe put on a few pounds, or maybe they've got a different haircut by then, and all these sort of things. And that's where we get involved to help that process, smooth that out, and make that final product look the best it can for all the different ways people are going to watch it: in the cinema, on their iPad, at home on their phone, on their telly in HDR, you know, in all those different mediums. That's us. We're making sure that everything looks absolutely, you know, the best it can, and sounds the best it can, because another big part of our company is looking after the mix and looking after what's called ADR, which is recording the voice of those actors, re-recording the voice for creative reasons, changing lines maybe for you know, for narrative changes of the story, or maybe there was, you know, a plane flew over on the day and we need to re-record that voice for some reason. So picture is the particular part that I'm heavily involved in, but sound's a big part of my company as well, and making sure that it sounds good, and therefore that final thing that's delivered is the best it can be. Is that layman's terms? Wow. Did I cover that?
You covered a lot of ground there, a lot of questions, but I think the key thing I felt from that, Val, and about you, is all of a sudden I've become very self-conscious of how we record this podcast.
Very, very. Yeah, I'm critical too.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting because we spoke to Vin Zhang quite a while now, who's a keynote speaker, and he was doing a lot of online training. This was during lockdown. And he was saying, you know, a lot of people, I mean, the way I put my mic now, I'm not looking into the camera. I'm talking, you know, at my screen when I'm looking at you. And, you know, how you have this sort of, you need to interact with people. So if I'm talking to you, it's better if I look at the camera like this, because it looks like I'm looking at you into your eyes. But if I actually looked at you, you're down here. And so those on YouTube are seeing the way I'm looking at the screen and the camera, et cetera, et cetera. But then you look at, I mean, Val and I have looked, obviously we listen and we watch other podcasts. You look at like Joe Rogan and all these others, and they've got the camera like this and it doesn't matter. And so we're not into movies as such, but it's quite interesting because for us, at least, we try and do as little editing and post-production as possible, because a tip we picked up early was just record it right first time. In the beginning, Val and I used a lot of and we're editing the hell out of everything. And then we decided to get out of jail free card. So what we did was we said we got a strap line, raw, informal, but informative. And we like, we're not going to edit anything. And so what listeners are going to hear today.
Maybe we should. Maybe
we should edit.
Production. Maybe Rob can help us out. Maybe we do some special editing just for this particular show.
But well, you know, this is the thing, isn't it? It's about keeping it raw. It's about keeping it raw and like working with, you know, understanding what you need to be. And I think that, you know, because you say you don't edit and you say you don't, but, you know, you've made aesthetical choices yourself to then have your mic there and put your camera there, because you kind of are working with, you know, things that you recognize and you've seen and you like. So, you know, you are keeping it raw, of course, but you're aware of those of the connotations of where you do look and where you do put yourself, and, you know, understanding your framing and where you are. So it's all those things that are really fundamental in filmmaking, but you're picking up on those things and you're finding your own way of adapting them into your little world, you know?
Yeah. I love it. So Val, when we were chatting with Chirag, when I met Rob, Rob gave Chirag some very sound advice, because Chirag loves to put out, you know, his Wednesday little sound bites, like, Chirag, like, don't put the camera that everyone looks up your nose.
The nostril angle. Yeah, that's actually really good. We would love some advice too, Rob. So maybe after the show, you can give us a few pointers. That would be great.
It's important. But that's the thing that, you know, it is about, you know, it's recognizing those things, isn't it? It's understanding where, you know, I'm so fortunate I get to work with these incredible cinematographers who are absolute masters of lighting and masters of framing, and, you know, and everything is sculpted, and it's so beautiful. And, you know, so fortunate to have worked on some things that you look at and you're just visually stunned by what they've done and how they've done that, you know. But that does then feed into what you do and how you then, you know, you take that photo, you know, and you make it the best you can make it, you know, and you're aware when it's good and it's bad, you know. And I think, you know, even this weekend I was with you know, Chirag, and we were taking a little photo of ourselves, and then someone else was taking a photo of us, and the better photo was the photo of us taking the photo of ourselves, because they caught a beautiful moment, you know. And I think that that's, you know, that's often the way you got to catch those moments, and you like, you know, so it all sort of ties together in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this you've got to have a keen eye for it as well. And obviously, Rob, you found your talent, your passion, you know, and for us in projects, it's a similar situation, except we're not looking for, I guess the aesthetics for us isn't lighting. It's not, you know, the frame, the moment caught, but it's patterns. It's recognizing things that could happen in the future. We tend to be very good at pattern recognition, I think, for people in the controls and PMO and project management space. We can pick up something that doesn't just seem right. There's a signal that we're tuned into, which I'm sure is the same for you when it comes to framing and the aesthetics of a production environment. You're like, that's not quite right, or it's a little bit over there. Is that the case? There's something intuitive. Definitely. To your business?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, bearing in mind that I'm not, you know, I'm not a creative in that environment. Do you know what I mean? Like that's it. So, but you know, you're talking about identifying those issues and recognizing where they can go wrong early. You know, that's massive in post-production. That's really important, you know. And I think that's something that I you know, really, you know, sort of bring into my staff is about understanding, you know, understanding that process, making, you know, every film is so completely unique and every TV show is completely unique, but the same pitfalls are there. You know, the same risks and, you know, and issues are going to come up through the process. So it's understanding, what are we checking? What are we putting our eyes to, you know, or our ears to through that process, to then be able to say, what do we need to, what do we need to look at next? What do we need to be ahead of to make sure that we're not going to fall into a problem too late, you know, when we've delivered that episode to the studio, to the network, and it's going to go out on TV next week, and then we realize that thing. So, you know, project control in post-production is massively important. You know, this is where, you know, me and Dale were talking, and I was saying about how, you know, how there is such a crossover, because these are, each episode is a little project, you know. Yeah. I work on a TV show on Apple TV called Slow Horses, which is this brilliant, like, it's one of my favorite TV shows that we work on. And we're into series, I think we're working on series 3 now, and series 4 is shooting at the moment. And we've got into a really good rhythm, a really good pattern of process with that production. But you still got to have that attention to what's going on, what could go wrong, where are the things that we got trips up on last time, to understand how do we make this as smooth as possible. Because the worst thing you can have in that thing is, this is series 3. We know what we're doing. You know, you don't know what you're doing. You've got to assume you don't. You've got to assume that, you know, you have to make sure that you're checking everything, and you're thinking about all those things that could go wrong. That, you know, where are those secrets that could come and catch you out. So yeah, visually we're looking at, you know, what's good, what's bad, what do we need to pay attention to, but we're also thinking about processes a lot of the time, and trying to recognize those patterns, that where do we get tripped up, where are we weak, where are we not putting our resources correctly to make sure that we're delivering this, you know, this episode correctly that first time, so that it's on screen, you know, without that risk of, you know, I go to so many screenings. I go to so many screenings of films or TV shows. I used to go, you know, in fear. You know, I used to go there and be thinking, oh my goodness, I just hope this is right. You know, and you can't live like that. You can't go to those screenings and be thinking, oh my goodness, I just hope this is right. You know, you have to, and it made me realize that you've got to be so far ahead of that. You've got to know where you are. You've got to be comfortable. You've got to have those processes in place so that you can go there and you can be like, I've seen this. I know what this is. This is great. I'm going to have a great time here, because we're good. And that, and that's massively about project control, you know, in post-production.
Do you feel like you're very judgy now when you go and watch other people's films and you look at post-production, you're like, I'm going to, what the hell is it? You can see where someone else has messed up. Do you get a bit like a bit judgy on others by accident? I mean, virtue of the job, I imagine.
My wife hates watching anything with me.
Do you comment a lot?
I pause a lot. I pause and rewind a lot. Okay, I pause and rewind a lot. I'm a horrible, horrible person because I will say, and I'll say to her, did you see that? And she goes, no, Rob, of course I didn't. And I think, did you not see that? You should have seen that. There was a thing. And they clearly had, you know, and you, and it, so it is a problem, yes. And but I think that as I've got older, I've got better at turning that off. I think I've got better at kind of, do you know what it is? I think that there are TV shows, there are films that I love. And when they are that good, you are so immersed, you're so absorbed that you can't see those problems because they are something that just exists and you just go along for the ride. And I guess it's when I'm not quite as invested or there's some reason where I'm like, this is 3 out of 5. This isn't, you know, that's when I start finding those problems and I start noticing them. So that's pausing. Probably start pausing.
That's when you start pausing. There you go. What is that? Yeah. Well, look, it is interesting that you can pause. Most of our projects, we don't have a pause button, but we would love to. We would love to pause.
Well, they're not my, you know. Yeah, and believe me, the projects that I'm working on, when I'm working on them, you know, you don't pause those. But, you know, you only get to pause the ones that are on the TV else. By then. Yeah. Someone else.
Well, there's so many synergies. I think one of the other things you mentioned, you have staff working for you, obviously young people coming into the industry. How have you handled things like attention to detail? Because I imagine, you know, that's a real big part of your job is to be focused and pay attention. One, is that something that you can teach? Two, what kind of mistakes have people made that you've just picked up immediately because they've made a big flub or flop on something? Love to hear those 2 points.
Yeah, I guess, can you teach attention to detail? You know, you can set in place a series of processes that make people realize what attention to detail is. You know, you can... And I guess that's what we continue to refine and continue to work on is, you know, keeping those key experienced people close to those new team members. You know, like I was talking about, you know, being a runner earlier and, you know, we're always looking for, you know, incredibly talented runners. We want runners that are going to be the next something. You know, I always say that being a runner is just one long job interview. You know, every day you're coming to work and you're trying to find where your next job is. But, you know, you've got to be on your A game every day because you're never quite sure, you know, that phone's ringing, you pick it up. You're never sure if that's the person saying to you, oh, could you just come up and give me a hand? And then you're making that move. So you're instilling into that, you know, that those people, the importance of what we're doing, because it's not a real job. It's silly. We're working in films and TV. You know, we're not teachers. We're not doctors. We're not nurses. We're not doing important things, but you've got to treat it with that, with so much respect because, you know, it's millions of pounds of studio's money and someone's money. And you've got to, you know, you've got to recognize and respect that. And so you try to instill into that group from the very outset the importance of attention to detail and the importance of making the right choice and committing and giving your all to this, to that, to whatever that task is. So yeah, you know, you can't teach it, but you can definitely make people aware what is our version of attention to detail. And then mistakes, you know, I mean, goodness me. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, you can sense, you know, doing this for long enough, you can see the people that are going to go off on their own and think they can do it. And the ones that want to prove themselves without maybe the, the experience and the ability that you need to shepherd through, and you need to oversee, and you need to make sure that, you know, they're not that lone wolf, and they're sort of, you know, really moving in the right direction. Because, you know, I'm making mistakes, you know, 15 years in, and, you know, 200, I think I've, you know, over 200 films in, and I'm still kicking myself for that thing that, you know, you didn't do or you didn't think about. But, you know, you're creating a culture of question, you know, you're creating a culture where people, your door's open and people are coming to you and they're asking you, you know, the best questions that people ask me are the stupid ones where they're like, I just wanted to check this. And you're like, great, because you're here and you're asking the question. You're not just going off thinking you know it, because you probably already know it, and you're just checking in to make sure that that's good. And now you're empowered to go and make that right choice. So, you know, I think that you're hoping that you're allowing people to make mistakes so that other people are catching those mistakes, because you've put in place enough, you know, fail safes and enough kind of checks that one person can make a mistake, because someone else is going to pick it up along the process here. And then that person is learning from that, you know. And I sat down today with a group of people about something that had gone wrong just yesterday. And I said, this is fine. You know, you got that wrong, and then that went wrong. And that's unlucky, because that's two things that went wrong that really wouldn't ever go wrong at the same time. But it's cool, because we did this thing, and therefore it didn't get out, you know, and it didn't go to air with any problems at all, you know, and so we caught it. But you're bringing them together and you're saying collectively, like, look at us all. We're doing this and we're just doing that. And here's how we caught that on the way. So you're hoping that you're putting in places those things. And yeah, you're using your experience of, you know, to hopefully signpost people towards, you know, that correct choice.
I like that in the situation, you're calling out almost the lessons learned and you're talking about them, you know, during the process, rather than, you know, we have this thing called lessons learned, but we do it kind of at the end of the project or at the end of the phase, and we kind of try and scrape everyone's minds at the end, and everyone's forgotten what the hell actually went wrong and what the lesson was to learn, or it's kind of arbitrary because the context isn't there, so you try and store it as a knowledge management piece and it never really works. But that's a really good piece. I mean, I imagine with post-production as well, timing is really important, and one of the biggest impacts is if you have a lot of mistakes, obviously a lot of rework that has to happen. So what's more important? Is it time or cost or both? Or how do you keep it within a range? Because obviously each series or each job that you're on, you've kind of quoted an expectation of time. How do you manage that rework and make sure that mistakes are kept to a minimum?
Yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate challenge. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, when do you do your recap? I mean, you know, we've got a project that's just come out, you know, big on a big streamer, and we did some catch ups through that process. You know, we did it after they sort of as a series, and they did it in a series of blocks. You know, you do sort of 8 episodes in total, and you do a block of 3 episodes, a block of 3 episodes, and then the last couple. And so we were catching up regularly through that process to make sure that, you know, block 1 was this. Let's make sure we do this for block 2. Right, block 3 is this. And so I was speaking to one of the team today, and they said, we didn't do a end of season catch up, and now it's on telly. Now it's on, you know, now it's available out there. There's not the urgency because it's out there, and we're so proud of it, and we're so happy with it. So we've not done that end of season kind of recap. But you go, well, that's cool, because we got to that thing and we got through that bit, and so the last bit was pretty good, you know, and we kind of probably learned our lessons through the process. And it does save you from having to have that kind of like, oh yeah, like 7 months ago, that bit was a real problem, you know. So it is really valuable to be constantly trying to check yourself. And it works very well in the episodic world, you know, episodic TV, you know, to be doing that, compared to features where, you know, it hits. Timing, budget, it's incredible. You know, these are, you know, when we're working on a feature film, you know, a big, huge Hollywood studio feature film, I mean, that's that's booked, that's into the cinema at a certain date, you know, that's not moving, you know. And though some of those Bond films, I mean, you know, they're not just films, you know, they're commercial enterprises that are selling cars, watches, water,
yeah,
beer, you know, they're enormous, you know, they're absolutely, you know, incredible, you know, sort of commercial ventures. And so you are working to a very hard deadline, you know, that if you don't, you know, you have to be done, you know, you can't say, oh, we're going to just need another week, you know, so deadly, you know, you can't leave those cinema seats empty on that release day. So timing is everything, you know, and understanding how you're going to structure your work to make sure that it's going to hit your deadline is fundamental. And therefore budgeting and making sure that those costs are built into that process, understanding where are the pinch points going to be here. Okay. Visual effects are going to come in at this point. You know, we know they're going to come in, you know, at this key time. Let's focus our resources here. Let's make sure that production are not wasting their money in the wrong time. Let's make sure they're spending their money here at this point where the most is going to happen. There's going to be the most pinch. You're trying to manage workload to make sure that you're spreading that out, because there's no point in pushing all of your work into one weekend because you just physically can't do it. But you're trying to manage that and say, okay, let's not do this weekend, let's keep everyone fresh because next weekend is going to be the thing, and then the weekend, you know, and that is, you know, and that's where we need to put ourselves. So timing is everything, you know. These things don't, you know, I think because they have that commitment to advertising, you know of any project, you know, it's booked its advertising space on social media, on domestic television, so it's got those things to hit, and it's booked that cinema slot, you know, that 100 cinema release, 200 cinema release, worldwide release, you know, and it's got to make it. And you know, there's a lot of pressure come the end, you know. We've been in some crazy situations where we've been making films, they're coming out that weekend, we're making a new version of that film because it needs, you know, they're going to run that version of the film today, but as soon as possible they're going to replace that version of the film with another version of the film that's better, you know. And so you're really, you know, timing is everything, and making sure that you're giving your team enough time to complete this film, you know, and to the best of everyone's ability.
So that's the tricky part. I mean, I think that's where there's synergy between your industry and our industry, Rob, is that we have the same challenge. I mean, obviously we have, I guess, the ability not to have to go to air straight away. I mean, some of the projects we work on are years before they start. Actually, that might be the same as you, Rob. Mm. Years and years and years go along. But the tricky thing is the crunch time always comes at the end. I'm just wondering, how do you plan that stage? If you're doing like a three block and maybe it's quite a big piece at the end of a large episode or something, or a season, how do you plan your weeks ahead of yourself? Do you have a system, a tool, a process, a method?
Yeah. So we, I mean, like, so we have a scheduling system. We have Zytec Media Pulse, which is a really, you know, really great system that we use. There are some other really incredible ones. Farmer's Wife is a tool that was sort of bought out of do you know Farmer's Wife?
No, it sounds great.
It sounds great, doesn't it? It's an amazing name. But it's kind of like an archive library system that then it produced some really great project management tools as well that we were looking at ourselves, because they were quite interesting within that media and that film industry. So we use what's ultimately a fairly straightforward scheduling system, but it's built out of an accountancy software, really. And so our team really, certainly our accountants particularly like us using that software, because it's a very user-friendly system for billing and for, you know, for invoicing and for sure, you know, doing that side of our work. And it has some really, you know, we've developed it with some really, you know, interesting ways of our team being able to sort of streamline some of their work to make sure that when they're, you know, when they're scheduling resources, it's intelligently bringing through some of the costs at that point to sort of be ahead of how you then might need to check it to make sure that, you know, did we book 8 hours for that day, but the actual hours were six, and we're only therefore need to invoice the six, you know. And it's got some very, you know, like, you know, familiar but really useful tools for our team to sort of keep that really streamlined. I can imagine the Dales just Googled farmer's wife and found nothing to do with filmmaking. And he's like, Rob, there's just a series of farmer's wives here.
It's a TV show as well. Farmer Wants a Wife. We did find the production. So it's very similar to what we do, Rob. It's uncanny that at least that skill set is transferable, I guess, to a degree. Sorry, my dog's decided to say hello to us. But I think so that's the tool you use. What's the kind of the best of the best tools instead of scheduling in production, post-production?
So, I think that, you know, really it's a really common one, you know, is what we use. I think we do use, you know, certainly, I think I, you know, I've been using that software for really since I first got into the industry, I think. And I've sort of lived many different iterations of it and got under the hood of it a little bit as well to sort of find out how we can use it better for specifically what we're doing. And so I do find it's pretty strong for what we need to do in terms of, you know, taking, you know, so many different resources and being able to kind of, you know, really schedule and understand, you know, what you're trying to do with them. I think Media Pulse, Zytec is really strong for that. Although they'll owe me like a tenner or something, you know. So, yeah.
That's great.
They'll put that on there.
Yeah, no, it is pretty awesome. I was looking at it in the background. I was like, it's really similar to it's almost exactly the same at what we look at with, you know, time and time reporting. You got a cool little app and you can log all the activities you've done, how many hours you spent on them. And, you know, it goes into a Gantt chart, as we would call it, or it's called a project timeline here. So, and then it summarizes. It's pretty neat.
I'm sorry to say that it's not more exciting. I'm sure it's sorry that it's not more exciting than everything you know. You know what I mean? I've demythified. Yeah.
No, the great thing about it is, you know, I mean, we're clearly trying to, you know, look at different industries and draw out, you know, what can we use, borrow ideas from other industries to improve the way we deliver projects. And I think a lot of it is that we focus on similar aspects to deliver outcomes or outputs, and it's around how you use those tools available to you rather than actually what the tool offers. I mean, that's important too, but it's the understanding of that collective goal. You know, is everyone on the same page? Are we all set to achieve what we set out to? Do we all know what the deadline is, what the objectives are? Is the scope clear? All that, you know, all those lovely things we love to talk about on projects. But the other thing that we love to talk about, and we chatted about this before we hit record, Rob, was technology and AI. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, actors are kind of looking to go on strike because of AI and all of that. And we spoke about Netflix and Black Mirror and all of that. Was it Joan is Horrible? What was it called? Joan is Awful. So that episode on the latest Black Mirror was really, really intriguing and scary. But I was wondering, as you were talking, is there a threat to all parts of film production with AI? Because would we ever get to a state where anyone could – would there be a ChatGPT for filmmaking, let's say, and anyone can now be a director, actor, producer, where they'll just put in the idea, here's the storyline, here's the plot, go ahead, write the full script, and you know what, auto-generate the full movie – and all the post-production and everything. Is there a threat like that technology has on the film industry?
Yeah. I mean, it's there. It's very apparent. And I remember the weekend that ChatGPT launched, me, a friend of mine who's an actor and a friend of mine who's a screenwriter and music producer, we were out, and we'd all collectively been on the train up to London together, discovering this new bit of kit, and we'd all done exactly the same thing with it. We'd all put in like, oh, write me a sequel to this film that I love, and it all, and each of us had kind of, you know, used it for that very basic first sort of thing where it was open. But, and what you saw is that, you know, at that point, you know, December last year or whatever, November, it was, you know, the limitations of it and the repetitiveness of it, you know, the key things, yeah, that it was hitting at the time. You know, you said to it, write me a film synopsis for this thing. And it kind of came back very common, you know, with a lot of commonalities, this, regardless of what you said. It picked up on the characters and it picked up on some key themes from the first film that you mentioned, but then it gave you a fairly sort of generic, they have some ups and downs and there's an ultimate resolution. You were like, oh, that's cute. Do you know what I mean? But now, 8 months later, yeah, you can tell it to write me this thing in the style of this thing. And I mean, this is a big thing that's going on with the writers. You know, this is why we've had 2 months of writer strikes, which have been massively, you know, massively impacting, you know, to the industry, because the American screenwriters are striking because they are quite rightly saying, hang on, AI technology, streamer, the streamer residuals, this is not accounted for in our current, you know, agreement with the studios. How is this going to work? How is this going to, you know, how is AI going to impact writing? And it's going to impact writing massively unless people understand that, you know, we need to value writers. We need to value the experience of writers and the talent of writers and protect them to ensure that AI, you know, doesn't just take over the what is the beauty of art, you know, in writing, you know. And so AI is a massive threat to some of those creative areas, writing being a really key one, because yeah, you can write now, you know, you can go to ChatGPT and you can ask it to write you a scene in the style of Friends, okay, with these characters from these different films and TV shows, but write it in the style, and it's there for you, and it's there, and you know, and is it good, is it bad, is art, you know, that's the difference, is what, you know, does it, is it reductive, and is it just, you know, a rehash, or is it clever and original and new? So so AI in writing is massively, you know, it's a massive risk, and in acting is a massive risk. You know, I think that there's technology now in AI for acting, where, you know, they can do all sorts of live mapping of faces onto actors to, you know, to make it look like you had that Hollywood actor in your film. Now, of course, there's image rights and there's rights to films that you can't just repurpose those things. So there's always, you know, there's safety in that process, but you know, right now it's not fully formed, but in 6 months' time it will be, you know, dangerous. And we were talking about, you know, and we, deepfake is very different because deepfake is a very niche, crafted, not necessarily AI based process. It's a more of a visual effects process, but that was a big signifier. You know, you watched things and the deepfake things a while back and you couldn't quite understand what you were watching, and the way you were watching these images and these sounds and saying, I don't know where I am here. What am I actually, what's going on? So AI is going to take that to another level.
Could you spot it with your eye?
No, I mean, don't believe that I've got that, you know, anything different. Don't believe I didn't watch that and be wowed and be like, hey, what's going on? Like, no, they're incredible, you know. So, but this isn't deepfake. This is AI. This is something different to that. This is mapping and understanding the, you know, this is taking images that exist already and repurposing them and augmenting them into live, you know, intelligently finding the right image to map live onto actors. So AI for acting is a big risk as well. Now, like I say, that image right sort of understanding and you know, and catalog is important, but that's a big risk. Directing, I think directing is the one place where I naively and maybe just romantically believe is safe, because AI, I don't believe that AI could direct a film, because you know, in that process, you're working in, you have emotion. You have such emotion in performance and such emotion in seeking and getting the right performance out of actors, and then understanding emotion within editing and within musical narrative and storytelling, that I just hope and believe that we have something in there that, and I sound like a right lovey now, but we have something in directing that isn't at risk. But that's only a part of our industry. That's only a small part, you know, of the industry that perhaps need, you know, and there'll be some incredibly talented directors who can work with AI. And then as soon as they start, you know, that's where AI will learn and will find a way into there perhaps. So yeah, you know, AI is a huge, you know, it's an incredibly exciting and incredibly dangerous and sort of scary thing that we're looking at, you know.
Yeah, it and it's only getting, you know, the time that this is happening, the time span in which it's happening in terms of development and better versions of itself. I mean, only recently it's released its code interpreter. So now it can write its own code and execute against that code, which is, if you start looking at the agents and start thinking broadly, and I think for anyone who can step into the future, which I imagine that's part of your job, it's definitely part of our job, you can kind of see the threads. I mean, we did the same thing, Dale and I, as soon as chat came out, we started playing with, you know, write me a project management plan or send me a risk register or, you know, develop anything. I mean, and I think there is an advantage to it if you're, you know, you can get it to suck in a script perhaps, and or maybe you've written an episode and you say, you know, tell me what I've, you know, give me some recommendations to improve this, and it could potentially provide an enhancement kind of feature. But the overtaking feature is also a concern from a commerciality perspective. Like if you want to maintain your artistic rights or your IP to a degree, that is all at jeopardy, because now you can write a Friends episode in the theme of Tarantino or whatever you want to do. And there's not much that can stop that from happening, because it is out there in the ether and it's completely disconnected from regulation, which is one of the issues that I'm pushing really hard for in Australia. You know, responsible AI is probably where there's some regularity, well, regulation. We don't need government heavy-handedness, but we do need a process to, like, keep, I guess, people free from those commercial anxieties. That's what I kind of call it, because I think they do deserve their moment in the sun if they do have the talent. And, you know, the director, I think that's a pretty safe role as well. It's kind of like the symphony maestro. I mean, I've heard some amazing symphonies written by AI, like full on amazing, but the improbability of us not using it. I mean, it's like having, you know, this amazing thing just sitting there, and there's a button you press and it does everything. I mean, humans love buttons. We love to press buttons. We love to push the edges as well. You know, we like to say, shit, if we just, you can imagine it, Rob, like you sitting there on a Friday, I wonder if I just gave this to AI, see what happens. You know, Friday night, and you start experimenting and merging things, and something great come out of that. Do you see it as a?
So I used it.
You did, yeah.
Well, I used it for some image generation. So there's some really interesting image generation stuff, and we were doing the Three Peaks challenge with a group of our mates, which is climbing the Three Peaks of around the UK within 24 hours, and we didn't quite make it. We just shaded it over 24, but I was using. I thought I need I want a logo for our group chat, and I thought, I'm going to use this image generation AI software to create me a logo. And so I plumbed into there the information, and I said, this is what I want. This is what, and sure enough, you know, you, you start off with that free tool, and you then use it a little bit, and you're like, oh, I've run out of things. This is quite interesting. I'm going to go in again, and you know, and very quickly you signed up to the full thing because you're like, this is amazing. I'm doing some incredible things, and that's an incredibly positive tool where it can be used really, you know, really. It's again, you know, you are potentially replacing a job, but you're not entirely replacing a job, because what you're doing is you can, in the film world, you can say, okay, I want to come up with this concept, or I want to shoot my film in this environment, and I'm going to use this image generation thing to say, I'm going to describe it, and I'm going to revise it and tweak it, and then find a bunch of images that I like, and be able to say to my set designer and yeah, here we go, here it is, here's what I want it to look like. Do you know what I mean? This is what I'm looking for, and all of a sudden, some of that, you know, some of that interpretation and some of the risk is gone from the process, because you've made it very literal, and so perhaps you're stifling some of the creativity of your art director, because you're saying, instead of saying, you know, 70s feel, and you're then going to use that creative mind of your art director to find that 70s feel, you've been able to be quite prescriptive and say, here is that 70s feel that I want. But that's not a bad thing for a director, because, you know, that's efficiency in some of that process, and therefore there's cost saving, because, you know, you're not having to go through weeks of prep and iterations of design, because you've been able to use some AI to help you, you know, help you create that thing.
Well, this is what it's actually on this podcast, Rob, that I kind of said this a while back, that at some point we'll get to a white canvas piece and there'll be AI behind this white canvas, and we literally just prompt the canvas to build whatever we want. It could be a tool, it could be a movie, it could be a major song. It doesn't really matter, but it gets you to, like, from a foundational level to like a concept level to almost like a detailed level that you can play around with. And then all of a sudden, the enhancement of imagination is what will be the most commercialized commodity, because I think that will flow into industries where we've arguably decided that we don't have creativity, like project management, where actually, you know, a lot of the challenges to solve problems is the ability to think outside the box a bit. I know that's a pretty common term, but a lot of people don't really know what that means. And I think it's defining problem solving using non-standard approaches. And so maybe there is a flow where, you know, production people can come into projects and project people can come into production, because the tools are not necessarily the things that stop us. Because for a long time, enterprise software to build all these things has been the firewall, because they have all the knowledge, they have all the techniques, they have all the methods, and everything's overspilling now, because now AI can take anything and build anything at any time based on anyone's kind of imagination, which I think is pretty cool. And as you said, pretty wild, pretty crazy, pretty dangerous all at the same time. Which, if you're a little bit risque, this is a pretty good time to be alive and have a mess around with some stuff. But what's the wildest thing you've done with AI to date, or some of your friends perhaps in that post-production space?
You can't share that on record.
I'll tell you what the wildest thing I did with AI and ChatGPT was, that I got it to write my 10-year wedding anniversary card.
Did it do a good job?
I mean, check with my wife. It sounded good to me. I mean,
you're still married.
Still married. Made it to 12. Made it to 10 and a half years. So
amazing, amazing. Yeah, because it does have the writing ability. I think that's where I think you said it first, right? The writing, the capacity for it to learn how to write. I do wonder though. Do you know? Like, there were some things about writing degradation in the actual large language model, because it was then ingesting its own information. So it kind of had this kind of eating its tail, if you imagine the snake eating its own tail. And it's kind of starting to consume its own information, and then it kind of doesn't make sense anymore, or the creativity's kind of gone, or you get into that repetitiveness, or maybe there's a point in which it kind of reaches its scalability, I feel. What do you think about the limits of AI? Do you think it's just going to continue to kind of go exponential, or do you think it'll hit a cap and be like, all right, there's something else will come out?
I, you know, I mean, right now it's so all consuming that you just can't see past it, can you? You can't look at, you can't, you kind of wonder what that next thing could be, because we are living this incredible new, you know, new technology right now that you kind of go, well, what is the next thing? Because, you know, you were saying earlier about, you know, about plugging it in, and you know, and I thought at that point, did films teach us nothing? You know, like we've watched all these 100%. Films where we know where this happens. You know, we know where this goes. We watched The Terminator, and we watched all these things, and we saw where, you know, how this ended up. So sadly, you know, when you say what happens, all I can think of is those outcomes, you know, where Arnold Schwarzenegger does come back, you know,
he's pretty old now though.
So that's he's old, but AI, you know what I mean? Is he old?
Yeah, you're right. I think there's a real danger to, we don't let it stop and we just keep going. And then, you know, we're kind of obsolete then. And the example is, we're like the ant on the anthill. You know, it's not that AI will, you know, well, it will surpass us in all areas, but when it does have a conflict, it won't treat us as an enemy. It'll just treat us as something in the way and just move us, you know, and we've got nothing really to stop it. And so it's a combination of all our imaginations and every movie that's ever happened about sci-fi and robots, and it's all coming kind of relatively true, which is pretty crazy that we would ever be alive to see robotics and sentient potential beings. And the fascination with romanticizing AI as well. What's your view on that? Because I think from a post-production perspective, that's pretty interesting. How do you know, there was a movie called Her with, was it Joaquin Phoenix? And, you know, there's all this romanticizing that humans will have this connection with AI in some sentient kind of form in the future. Does that spark your imagination as well, Rob?
Do you know what those all do? I am a sci-fi fan. You know, I love those stories, and I love the escapism of what that might be, but only because, and that was from reading all sorts of, you know, classic sci-fi as a kid. But right now we're talking about Black Mirror, we're talking about Jonah's Awful, and we're saying, you know, there it is, the gap between sci-fi, you know, and real life, what's happened in 25 years of me being, you know, is that it's just become accessible, and sci-fi is now, you know, and that's wonderful, that's so exciting, that's so brilliant, because those things they no longer have to be set in a far off distant mythical future, because in fact we can live that sci-fi now, and we can experience it. And so I'm all for the romanticizing of it, because it's brilliant, it's amazing. Do you know what I mean? It's like it couldn't be, and I think from a storytelling point of view and a narrative point of view, it's even better. And I think that, you know, Charlie Brooker in that Black Mirror series continues to do that. He continues to, you know, sort of find these points in our life that should be sci-fi that aren't sci-fi. They are just, you know, well, they're neither sci nor fi, you know, they're just now, you know, that's brilliant. That's exceptional filmmaking and TV making, that, you know, you can tap in and find those, you know, those experiences and real world experiences and put them into, you know, because when we watched Minority Report and we saw all those things with the screens and the intelligent, you know, and we saw target advertising, you know, where they would walk past the billboard and they would recognize the person and see, you know, and you go, all right, maybe we haven't quite got that specific thing, but we've got that. You know what I mean? And so, and that was then, but, you know, you look now and you see those things in modern day, what would be modern day sci-fi, and you just can't help but enjoy and be amazed that we're there, we're living it. And these things, you know, these absolute touch points, you know, are very real now. It's great. I love it.
Don't you think the biggest threat is you can't believe your ears or your eyes anymore? you know, and the reality thread, I think, I mean, movies do a great job at capturing the culture of a particular time or decade or, you know, essence. And, you know, now it's all about kind of this AI piece, which is the, kind of the birth of this super intelligence piece that, that, you know, can almost fake everything we look at, we read, we observe. And we already have this challenge with the internet just being full of, you know, it's kind of like space junk. There's just so much crap out there that, you know, you're just getting, you have to filter so much to figure out what exactly is going on now. You can't trust anything, blah, blah, blah. Don't you think that that's going to be a real challenge? Not necessarily for movies. I mean, it's going to make some great movies. Even someone listening to this podcast might just be inspired to write a movie, and I encourage them to. But don't you feel like we are slipping from reality when we can't tell the difference between a deep fake, perhaps, and a real actor? Or how is that going to impact yourselves in production?
But you know, films, TV, they've been lying to us for years, and we've been going back to it, but in the most beautiful escapist way. Do you know what I mean? It's what they're there for. Do you know what I mean? You know, scripted reality TV, you know, being a prime example, you know, like we've been consuming and accepting and believing and loving reality TV.
You're saying it's not reality TV. Are you saying it's not real?
maybe we found the title for the podcast, you know. I'll find out the truth. But you know, we've been doing that for a long time. You know, we've been letting that happen consciously. You know, we've been told that it's scripted reality, and we've been looking past it and enjoying it and loving it, because that entertainment and that escapism is massively part of, you know, filmmaking and TV making. And so so we're talking about it, but we've always been, you know, actually signing up to it and enjoying it. And, you know, and it's kind of this, you know, this unwritten rule of that entertainment industry is that I'm going to commit this time to you, television, Netflix, Disney Plus, Amazon. I'm going to commit this time to you, and I'm going to let you tell me what's going on, and I'm going to love it or I'm going to hate it, and I'm not going to watch the next episode. And that's where my control is. You know, I can decide what I want to do. But when I'm in for good, and I'm going to binge those series. I'm not going to watch the credits. I'm going to watch just the episode, you know, until Netflix tells me, are you sure you want to watch another one, you know?
Excellent.
It's so fascinating because, I mean, well, firstly, Val learns the truth every episode that he's on. So it's not surprising, which is great. And I love the fact that he's learning another truth here. But, you know, we don't actually truly know if we're in the Matrix or not right now. You know, we could take, you know, the red pill or the blue pill, and we could wake up somewhere where we didn't expect to wake up. And, you know, there might or might not be something stuck in the back of our real necks. Who knows? But there's also, and you touched on it there, Rob, there's also this responsibility piece of films, I think, because there's one that if you are fully consumed, and there's age restrictions and things for kids and all of that because the level of understanding. But a lot of, I think, the way people look at certain things are influenced by what they watch. And their realities become almost an extension of what they consume in terms of what they watch as well, whether that be a Netflix series or something on YouTube or a specific type of genre they're into, from music all the way through to film. And it's quite a fascinating thing, because if we bring in this whole AI discussion on how that might influence what content is out there, it's quite scary if it's unregulated. But then there's the other argument that says, well, actually, if you think about it, as I guess Val was talking about, you know, the snake that consumes its own tail, perhaps if not for film, we wouldn't have pushed the boundaries in technology as much as we have today, because it gave us either ideas or inspiration to create the reality of what was once fantasy. So it's such a fascinating space to be in. In many ways, I'm envious that you are in the profession that you are. But I wonder what your take is on all of that. It's quite a wide-ranging, I guess, comment from me. But I think where I'm getting at is, what's the responsibility piece that films play in terms of giving, you know, the general public at large out there, the opinions and the view on the world that they have, and also the part that films play in driving creativity and driving humanity forward, whatever forward means.
Yeah, and I guess that's it, isn't it? Because there's different facets to and purposes to film, you know, to films and TV, and they can inform and entertain. They can just inform, you know, and they can just entertain, you know, and then there's a whole range of things in the middle of that, you know, and that's what art is, you know, that's what, you know, that's what we're talking about is understanding the purpose of these things. And you know, you look at All Quiet on the Western Front was, you know, one, loads of Oscars this year, and one of our colorists was the worked on that, and we're incredibly proud to have been associated with such an incredible film, and it, there's such a, you know, it's a amazing, powerful book that that then was turned into this incredible film, Relentless, you know, like a real, you know, a real powerful piece of cinema that is so important as a story to tell and as an experience to educate a new, you know, a new generation of Europeans specifically, you know, and it's a really important piece in Germany, obviously, and so sometimes you're part of something like that where you feel, and there was another film, you know, Belfast was last year, again, like a really, but on a completely different level, a film that dealt with, you know, the Troubles, and it dealt with, you know, before the Troubles really, but growing up in, you know, in Ireland and that environment. And they're really important pieces. They have such responsibility to be present and to be consumed and understood and to therefore educate. But at their heart is also entertainment. They are also there to, you know, to understand that we can make documentaries, but in that world of filmmaking, there's something else going on. You know, there's something else about telling a story and the poetic license of telling a story to illustrate this very important, significant moment in time, you know, which needs to be, you know, really needs to be heard. And so there's massive responsibility on those things. And then there's a film like The Meg 2, The Trench, about a giant shark, which is amazing, but it's not educating us. It's just there to provide that entertainment, and my goodness me, go and see that film, it's incredible. So there's a real, you know, there is this incredible wide range of responsibility and expectation of these of the things, you know, that I get to work on, and you really do sense a completely different tone and a completely different work ethic when you're working on different things, because you understand where there are things that are personal to the filmmakers that have a completely different significance and a different passion to those that are these incredible fun conceptual kind of things. We did a film called Rocket Man. I don't know if you ever saw that. It was about Elton John, which was this incredible. It was genuinely one of my favorite things to work on, musically beautiful. But it was a fictional retelling, beautiful fictional retelling of this, you know, biopic that really actually probably furthered some of the myths and some of the beautiful stories of Elton John, that we have to give, and we do give as much time to as one of those stories that are of, you know, incredible historical significance, that are telling those you know, those incredibly important stories. So it's really interesting to find that balance and to adjust yourself as you walk into those different rooms when those two things are happening, but most importantly, to find the enjoyment and find the love in doing both those things, and realizing that they're both contributing so beautifully to the industry and to people's lives, and to feel very blessed and very lucky that you get to be part of that, you know, as you do it.
Yeah, amazing. We can both tell you're deeply passionate about what you do, and you clearly love it, and which is amazing, because, you know, it's, we say it on the podcast when we talk to other professionals as well, and genuinely everyone we talk to loves what they do. And it's great to hear from someone outside of our profession and outside of our industry, you know, what goes on, and see that same enthusiasm as well, and the love for what they do. So thank you for sharing that. As we head to the end of the podcast, it'd be remiss of me not to ask you some questions you've probably been asked by plenty of people, you know, things like name dropping, you know, some famous people you've perhaps worked with or have encountered with, the best films you've worked with, and things like that. So we haven't done this in a while, where we used to have a few episodes ago, a pop quiz. So just quick fire question. So whatever comes to the top of your mind, and let's see if this works for you. So we've tailored it for you. Okay, so question one, this is five questions. What are the top five films you've worked on?
Top five. Goodness me. Do you know what? Like, that's so unfair, because, like I said, I've been so lucky to work on you know, genuinely, I can't believe it's been like over 200, you know, films and TV shows. And I will hate myself for answering this question, because I will leave my office and I'll think of 10 more that I should have said. But my goodness me, I hate you for doing this. Okay, right. Well, I am going to say a couple that I've mentioned already, probably, but I think, you know, Rocket Man, I think, was just the, like, I think filmmaking has to be fun, and that embodied fun. You know, I think that the director, the DOP, they got it, and they had this incredible kind of fun attitude to making this what was a remarkable and, you know, brilliant, really brilliant film. So Rocket Man's there. Skyfall will be another one. I was fortunate enough to work on two Bond films, which is just ridiculous. And Skyfall was, you could tell we were making, you know, I say we were making it so unfair. I was part of a film that was different. You know, it was a different moment for Bond. You know, it was a different thing. And the people involved in that just are the very top of their game. You know, they are, you know, Sam Mendes, you know, Roger Deakins, they're just incredible filmmakers. And you really felt that as you were in a room, blessed to be part of that process. I think then, I'm going to say, I've said these, but Slow Horses, that TV show is just exceptional. I think that the writing and the performances, and again, the direction and cinematography, is remarkable. If you haven't seen it on Apple TV Plus, go and get your free month subscription. If you don't want to pay, go get your free month subscription and watch it. Watch it all. it's remarkable. I promise you, it's hilarious. It's powerful. It's brilliant. I'm going to... Yeah, okay, I'll give you one more. Okay. There's a brilliant British filmmaker called Ben Wheatley. And I've been lucky enough to work with him for maybe 13 years and across a whole range of his films. But he made this one film called Free Fire, which you may not have heard of, but it's this absolutely brilliant... five-star cast, incredible film about a group of cons who have retreated to a safe house, and one by one, perhaps they're trying to screw each other over. Who knows what's going on? It's called Free Fire. It has Brie Larson in it, and and Cillian Murphy's in it, and also a beautiful cast of incredibly talented individuals. I'm sure Cillian Murphy's in that. I'm sure he is. And Ben Wheatley is this incredible director. So I'm going to give you four. I can't give you any more because I'll have to look at. Do you know why? Because I'll have to look at my IMDb profile to check check what I'm missing to know. So I've given you four. I've given you four incredible films. If I give you five, it'll be Belfast. It would probably be Belfast, which is Sir Kenneth Branagh made a film that we were involved in. A black and white this film about Ireland. His story growing up in Ireland. And there we go. So there we go. I've given you five. Oh my goodness me!
Amazing. So you've again. Literature.
Four more story. Four more questions. This is unfair.
So this one hopefully is an easier one. Maybe not. Your favorite encounter with an actor or director?
Oh man, that's incredibly difficult because you know I'm gonna try and find a fair one. I've been so lucky like to get to work with so many incredibly talented. Incredibly talented people. It's been quite remarkable. And I think, okay, I'll give you this story. So we were lucky enough to work with the musician Kate Bush on some of her music videos. And she was doing her residency at the Hammersmith Apollo, where she did a series of concerts there. I think it was like maybe 10, 15 nights. I think it's quite a long residency. And we worked alongside her to create some visuals for the show. And she said, would you like to come along to the show? And we'd all tried to get tickets and none of us had managed to get tickets because it had sold out like that. And so we said, yes, we'd love to come. That's really kind. So I took along one of the editors from our company and got shown to our seats halftime. They said, Kate would love to see you after the show. Would you come up to the green room? Yeah, that's lovely. Thank you very much. We would love to come and see Kate afterwards. So we get up to the green room and in there is Terry Jones from the Pythons, from Monty Python, and Big Boy from Outcast. And and then of course Kate comes in and we're all having a chinwag and we're all having a chat. And I just sort of take that moment where you look around the room and you go, that's Kate Bush. That's Big Boy from Outcast. That's like one of my comedy heroes, Terry Jones. And I'm here. What am I doing here? What? This is absolutely ridiculous. And I always say it's like the Graham Norton green room that no one asked for, you know, it's the weirdest thing in the world. So I've been lucky enough to have many strange celebrity encounters, but there is the one that I always look back on and go, how did I get here? How did I get there? How did I get here?
Wow. Awesome. Awesome. Three to go. You'll be pleased to know. your favorite film of all time.
As bad as the first question. Can you have favorites? Can you really have favorites? Because it aren't favorites about a moment in time and about where you are. You know, you mentioned The Matrix earlier, and I think that 15, you know, like 20 years ago, I'd have told you that The Matrix was my favorite film ever. And then I'd tell you that North by Northwest was my favorite film ever. And then, the film that I most want to go watch most frequently is The Departed, you know? And so I don't know. That is one that I will just refuse to answer because I think that like the way that your favorite song or your favorite album is so connected to an emotion and connected to a time that you can't pin it down to a single thing, because, you know, you will return to those same things over a period of time, but you know, you can never settle on something. You know, if you settle on something, then you're not open enough to realize that they might be something better at some point, you know?
Yeah. There's no right and wrong answer to this. It's your answer. It's the right answer. Number four, your favorite actor of all time.
Ooh. Oh, my goodness. That's really hard. Yeah, no, I got, that's really tough, isn't it? How would you guys answer that?
You can say Chirag. Chirag will listen.
He will listen. But you know what? Chirag will be so happy that we mentioned him so many times. Do you know what I mean? Well, I don't know. Go on. Who would you say your favorite actor is? See? There we go. That's the correct answer. It's really hard, isn't it? Because I think that, you know, you see, you can't look, there's some incredible classic actors that you kind of, you know, but, you know, you kind of look at Gary Oldman as someone who is kind of, you know, kind of unrivaled, you know, but, you know, that it's so hard to pick one, because you're picking them for a role, aren't you? You're picking them again. You're saying that person in that thing. So, you know,
Although for me, two spring to mind, because I think I've seen them in lots of different types of roles. And I think one is Tom Hanks, potentially. And then the other one is Matt Damon.
Okay.
Play a variety of roles. So maybe those, I don't know. But yeah, if you put me on the spot, that's what I would say.
So I worked on a film called Captain Phillips. I worked on a film called Captain Phillips, which Tom Hanks was in. And that was, you know, again, one of the most incredible performances ever, you know, really ever. Do you know what I mean? That was, he was remarkable in that film, you know, and I think that, yeah, Tom Hanks is exceptional. He really is.
I'm going to put in, I think Robin Williams is amazing. He's awesome.
Yeah. And,
and I love wise guys movies. So I love Al Pacino so much, and Joe Pesci. Like, I love all those old classic movies, The Goodfellas, Casino. Like, I love them. So those guys pop to mind. So now you're stuck, Rob. Now you have to say.
Well, I see. Like, but you say that, and then I immediately think of think of The Irishman, which was, you know, genuinely, like, you know, which was just an amazing 3 hours of your life where you were like, I can't believe this incredible film exists and I got to see it. And, you know, and you go, is Bobby De Niro, therefore is it Robert De Niro? Should it be Robert De Niro? Should we all actually just accept that Robert De Niro is, he can do comedy. He can do,
he's good.
You know, he can do it, you know, and so I probably today, right now, until I walk out of here and go, oh no, actually, I'm going to say Robert De Niro.
The only problem with that, because Robert De Niro is great as well, is that he had the blue-colored eye, I think the contacts or something. I just couldn't get past it for the Irishman. Remember? Yeah. He had these contacts in. I just couldn't. It was like, should have just left him brown eyes. Yeah. But then he had to have blue eyes for the movie. So, there you go.
Right. So the final one, and I think this one you'll get, Rob. If you could choose to have a superpower for a day, what would it be and why?
Do you know what? I think that I've always been obsessed with flying. I think it's because I'm sure it's some sort of, you know, I'm sort of childhood thing about, you know, going on holiday in England forever and not getting in a plane until I was sort of 14 or something like that, which is not a long time, but, you know, it's like a, you know, it felt like forever when you were obsessed with flying as a kid. And so I think that, I think that, therefore, a superpower of flying feels like entirely selfish, which is the sort of superpower that I think, you know, we're talking about here, because, you know, the ability to heal and the ability to see the future, they sound all too much like good work for everyone. I want to fly. I want to do it for me. I'm fed up of giving back with these amazing films and TV shows. I'm going to say, I want to fly for a day. I'll fly.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, we've had flying. We've had invisible, being invisible. We've had a few different things, but that's awesome. Thanks for being such a great sport, Rob. And thanks for spending, you know, the best part of almost an hour and a half. I mean, it's flown by, but it's been such a fascinating discussion with you. And, you know, I mean, if you're up for it, we'd love to have you back for, you know, a sequel, shall we call it. But, you know, before we let you go, though, are there any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
No, listen, thanks for having me on. It's been great. It's been really interesting to talk to you guys. And it's, you know, as we spoke about before, you know, I think that there's so much, you know, there's so much unspoken project management in what we do. You know, I think that there's, you know, it's a very much a forgotten kind of and sidelined process, you know, within what we do. But you know, it's there. It's so common. And I think that, you know, the importance is really understanding and recognizing what it is, you know, what we're doing and understanding that, you know, it's really important and fundamental to so many different processes, so many different industries, you know, and you guys have such specialized sort of, you know, history and, Val obviously has been doing all sorts of things, but, you know, you it's easy to speak and to connect that within, you know, a few groups, and yet it exists everywhere, doesn't it? And it exists in so many different areas. So I'm incredibly grateful that you asked me on and asked me to be part of it. And I'm, you know, and I've really enjoyed doing it. And yes, you know, I'd love to come back again. Only if we can come back so many times that I've come back more than Chirag. That's what I'm aiming for now.
The challenge is on. The challenge is on. But the pleasure is all ours. Val, any final thoughts from you?
No, thank you, Rob, for entertaining us. You did a great job, and it absolutely opened up, I guess, a new stream of thought for a lot of people who have listened and not necessarily known much about post-production and the movie industry, but can see the synergies now between what we do and what they do. But yeah, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Guys.
Absolutely. It's been such a pleasure and privilege. Folks, that is all the time we have on this episode, but please remember, before you go, do help us pay it forward by sharing a link to this episode on your favorite social media. Once again, a massive thank you to our guest, Rob Farris, and thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me and Val, it's bye for now.
Project Chatter supports and is a member of Zero Construct. Zero Construct is a new working group that wants to lower carbon construction. Not everyone will be aware, but construction contributes to around 12 to 15% of total carbon emissions.
This is a staggering amount, and we need to reduce it. We are a growing community of people that want to help make this change. Everyone is welcome, whether you're an engineer, contractor, or consultant. You just need to want to make a difference.
Our aim is to grow a network of experts so we can all learn from each other and make a positive impact in the places where we work. We'll do this by sharing knowledge and making it accessible in engaging ways.
To join us and find out more, please visit zeroconstruct.com and register as a member. Thank you, and we look forward to speaking with you soon.
For more information, blogs, or to support our charities, visit projectchatterpodcast.com. And if you would like to sponsor the podcast, get in touch via our website.
You can also leave us a voice message via our anchor page and let us know if there's something or someone specific that you would like on the podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.